food.
Dienstag.
Eine Seho oder Co.
Seho.
Ah, die ist die Jusche. Ja, also Start.
Start.
Ja, die
ist
mehr.
Was ist
Start? S-T-O-C-K.
Ja.
Die Bedeckung. Ihr seid stark, ja.
Ja.
Füllbar, ja.
Ja.
So jetzt fängt ihr Feed stark. Nur die Quink.
But I think it says, I think it may have something to do with
oil.
Yeah,
he talks
about
it.
Yeah.
But
what? Okay, we get to that. So, yeah, I often will be meet go again and begin with Lynn's new article. Men bare som introduktion. I går var det en konference i Ottawa om Canada og den eurasiske landbrug, som var en opfyldende konference til den vi havde i Kiedrich, hvor Henrik faktisk var med blandt andre, om den eurasiske landbrug. Og begrebet er, at hvis vi kunne få en politisk skift i Amerika, og få en samarbejde op at stå mellem Canada, Amerika og Mexico, så kunne det danne en kerne af nationer, som vil gå i gang med langsigtede infrastruktur- og opbygningsarbejder, som er nøglen til en genoplivning af hele verdensøkonomien. Så jeg tror, det var 80 mennesker, som deltog på konferencen, og vi havde en delegation af 4 mennesker fra vores kontor og samarbejdspartner i Sydamerika, som var med, som også holdt til tale. Og LaRouche var med fra Tyskland og holdt en meget kort tale, som vi vil lytte til. Og så de andre ting, som er meget spændende, der skete i den vestlige halvkugle, det var, at Christina Fernandez de Kirchner overtog magten i Argentina fra sin mand Néstor Kirchner.
Ja.
Så det ville være en videreførelse af Kirchners politik, hvor han stillede sig op imod den internationale valutafond og på befolkningssiden og virkelig kæmpede for det almene vel. I en situation, som var meget vanskelig, fordi Argentina havde været en af de ledende økonomier i hele verden, med hensyn til fødevarer og industriproduktion, og havde en meget høj livsstandard, og så blev de fanget i den her gældsfælde, skabte den internationale valutafond og andre store banker. Og deres økonomi var både helt sammen, og livsstandarden var helt nede. Det var, ja, jeg ved ikke om det var 50% af befolkningen, som lider under fattigdom, men den virkelig langt nede. Og så under de år, da Kirchner har været præsident, så har vi fået en gældssanering på plads med den internationale valutafond og storbankerne. Og nu er Christina Kirchner faktisk, som havde været politisk aktiv meget længere end sin mand, hun nu overtager. Hun har været senator. Og vores ungdomsbevægelse var med til the inauguration.
Og,
vi har en ungdomsbevægelse. Og faktisk har vi en dansk argentiner, Carlos, som er aktiv. Han er lidt ældre, ja. Men han arbejder sammen med de unge dernede. Og det sker samtidig med, at i sidste uge, så var der 6 eller 7 nationer, som underskrev en dokument for at etablere The Bank of the South. Det er flere sydamerikanske, mellemamerikanske nationer,
ja.
Som vil samarbejde som en alternativ til den internationale valutafond og storbankerne, for at skabe kreditter til opbygning. Og det er kun én ting, så, hvor LaRouche siger, at det er faktisk en fraktionskamp involveret, som vi skal kigge på. Men de har en potentiel til at virkelig gøre noget stort med den her Bank of the South. Så ja, og den aller seneste var, at Bernanke, the Federal Federal Reserve Chairman i Amerika, kom ud med en udtalelse, at nu vil centralbankerne samarbejde, og den første de vil gøre, det er at udstede 2 gange 20 milliarder dollars som likvide kapital til dem i finanssystemet, som bløder. Og det lyder som mange penge, men i forhold til dem, der bløder derude, og den store mængde af spekulationsbobler, så er det faktisk
ingenting.
Og det eneste, det gør, det er, at det fortsætter med den her politik om, at hvis vi bare pumper penge ud i systemet, så kan vi håndtere det på den måde.
Jeg har et spørgsmål.
Ja.
Hvis vi tager den samme dato sidste måned, så bruger jeg 116 kroner mere.
Mm-hmm.
Altså siden cirka den første, eller?
Uh-huh.
Altså i løbet af den sidste måned.
Ja.
Men det er det en snigende inflation?
Det
fordi det er ikke sket i mange år.
Hvis du går hen til en bager, så har de skilte nu, som forklarer, at deres råstofpriser er steget enormt, og det er derfor, at de er nødt til at tage mere for deres varer. Og det er det, vi siger. Det er derfor, Lind siger, at vi skal have en reorganisering af systemet. Fordi hvis centralbankerne mener, at de kan løse den her med bare at pumpe likvide kapital ind i systemet og ikke reorganisere systemet, så får vi en form for hyperinflation, som er langt værre end 106 kroner forstand.
Ja, jeg er godt klar over.
Hvis på den anden side, hvis de vælger ikke at gøre noget for at prøve at stoppe op de her huller, så får vi en kollaps af mange og mange store finansinstitutioner. Så det er derfor, den siger, at og det er formålet med den her, som vi vil begynde at læse igennem i aften. Our USA needs a real candidate. Let there be a time of Thanksgiving. At det er op til at finde præsident, mindst en præsidentkandidat, som viser, at hun eller han er kvalificeret til at lede sådan en konkursbehandling for ikke bare den amerikanske økonomi, men hele verdens økonomi.
Det er noget af det sværeste.
Ja, men det er gjort for. Så skal vi lytte til LaRouches tale fra i går?
Ja.
Du vil ikke følge med.
Jeg tror, jeg har den her.
Og så ideen er at bare sige stop, når det er noget, som I ikke forstår, enten med hensyn til sproget eller begreber, så stopper vi.
Mr. LaRouche, who is currently in Germany, but he's given us his time today to discuss these great issues.
We're presently at a point of great world crisis. It's one of the biggest, probably will be, unless we can control it, the biggest crisis in modern European history. We had something similar during the 14th century, the so-called New Dark Ages, with the collapse of a number of the banks of Italy, the Lombard banks, so-called. We're facing something similar today, but in a different time, with different characteristics. There are remedies, but the remedies require a certain kind of optimism about the future of mankind. And here we are in the United States, Mexico, and Canada, which essentially is the hard core of the Northern Hemisphere of the Americas. We're also at a point that we have an option for close development, co-development with parts of Asia, particularly the Russian part of Asia, the connection between northern Siberia and northern Canada and Alaska is fairly obvious. Here we have areas to the northern part of the hemisphere in two continents, very thinly populated, but rich in mineral resources and other kinds of resources, and also which are capable of supplying improvements in the water management, the freshwater management of the respective continents, or the northern part of the continents. And if we can link these as we can, that is Siberia to Canada, Alaska, and down into the States and into Mexico, we have the basis for a real renaissance in the economies of these regions of the world, which in the case of northern Siberia, for example, is largely an area which will be of mineral significance and transport significance for some time to come. We have a similar kind of situation in northern Canada and in Alaska, areas which are thinly populated because of the climate, but which have rich resources underneath the soil, and which means that this is a great leverage for developing the respective countries and for participating in the development of the hemisphere as a whole. We have recently, of course, this meeting in Russia, in which I was an indirect participant, but an enthusiastic one, for the development of a railway system, a tunnel, from northern Siberia into Alaska, down into Edmonton and so forth, and into the States, a railway system which would connect, obviously, with some additional rail development through Central America into South America. This would mean, with this kind of rail development, the larger part of the world, including Africa, Eurasia, the Americas, would be directly connected by rail lines, which would be a much more efficient way and cheaper way of transporting valuable goods at fairly decent lapse of time around the world. It means we can make more efficient and cleaner use of our resources. It means a great improvement in the prospects for populations throughout the region. For example, take the area of northern Mexico. Mexico has had for some time a development project, particularly one for the Pacific coast, which is most relevant for our concerns here, which runs up into the province of Sonora. Now, here we have a problem of population migration. We had a great influx of population fleeing Mexico because of a lack of employment opportunity and so forth into the United States. And now there's a reversal of that, of pushing the people who were immigrants into the United States as largely as cheap labor and pushing them suddenly back, 1 or 2 million or more Mexicans, back to Mexico where there are no places of employment open for them. They have, however, in that area, they have one project which is quite accessible in this water project, which could open up a whole section of the province of Sonora, the state of Sonora, which is where the kind of production which these families largely were involved in beforehand. And this would connect the water system to that of the United States and to Canada and to Alaska, which would mean that we would have a better management of fresh water. We'd be able to overcome in large parts of the continent the fact we're running out of water in areas which where fossil water has been relied upon. That is water that was deposited there a long time ago, and we're now drawing it down. We have a collapse in the entire central United States, the collapse of the soil, literally, through the collapse of these central water systems. We've had a project for that purpose standing for a long time. Then you look at the other end of the thing, take the northern, the Arctic region. And the Russians have some excellent ships there, which are nuclear-powered, which means that the entirety of this Arctic region is now opened up for transportation. And considering the kinds of things we have to transport, that's pretty valuable. But it means that the whole region now is opened up as an area of development, at least for mining and related kinds of things. So this is a chance to open a new era for this part of the world, for Asia through Siberia, Canada, Alaska, the United States, and Mexico, and from there on to other parts of the world. The time has come. Well, we've had so many crises up to now. We've been through periods of wars, two wars in the last century, major wars, world wars, so-called. We've also had the long period of the Cold War. We have the recent strife, which is destroying the United States. It's being sucked down into the dirt by the cost and drag of this war in West Asia. And the time has come to rebuild. Time is to come to rebuild with peace, to rebuild not on the basis of globalization as such, but on the basis of sovereign nation states in partnership and cooperation in the tradition of the Great Treaty of Westphalia, the Peace of Westphalia. The time has come to get out of these wars and to bring nation states into modes of cooperation where their sovereignty is assured. And of course that's very important for us in North America. Mexico is very proud of its sovereignty. The United States is proud of its sovereignty, and Canada is proud of its own sovereignty in its own territory. And should not be any imposition of one nation on another, or dilution of these sovereignties. But we can cooperate in the tradition of the Treaty of Westphalia, the Peace of Westphalia. We can consider the advantage of our neighbor, our partner, and find that by cooperating with them, like the United States assisting the development of Canada, Canada assisting the United States and Canada assisting Mexico, and the reverse, that the principle of Westphalia, the advantage of the other, the benefit of the other, can be the proper relationship among nation states, sovereign nation states. And if we can do that among ourselves with a project like this we're discussing here today, we can probably inspire other parts of the world to join us and get out of this mess we've been in for the past century and longer, and finally get to a system of sovereign nation states, but sovereign nation states consistent with the Treaty of Westphalia, the Peace of Westphalia, to cooperate and to benefit one another. And our motives should not be to compete with one another as such, not to try to beat one another, to take advantage over one another, but rather to see what each of us can do as a nation to contribute to the benefit of the other. And that was laid down in the Peace of Westphalia, and if we remember what that time was like, and see certain similarities to that kind of war situation in the wars of the past century, and of the recent wars in Southwest Asia, and the threat of the spread of these wars, the spread of terrorism, now in the Americas as in Southwest Asia, the time has come to bring about peace. We had a similar situation in just recently with the Annapolis Conference held inside the United States with nations represented from various parts of the world, especially from Southwest Asia. We had Syria, Israel, other states meeting at Annapolis and coming to an attitude of cooperation. It's not yet home, we're not yet secure on this, but we took a great step forward. Not a great accomplishment, not a great treaty, but a change in attitude. A change in attitude which promises an opportunity for bringing to an end this mess in Southwest Asia. And by cooperating to that purpose, we in other parts of the world, we can do the same thing. As I would say, the time has come to make a fundamental shift in the way in which nations have functioned in recent times. The wars of the last century, the continuation of wars and threats of wars in this century, the onset of a financial crisis, which is one of the worst, certainly the worst in modern history unless we control it. So we're now at the point we have to control this financial crisis. We can. That won't deal too much with that here today. But one step in that is large-scale projects of cooperation in building infrastructure in particular, which involves cooperation among nations in developing raw materials where we need them to deal with a very threatening shortage of raw materials, to get into new kinds of power, which are cleaner and better and more powerful, this sort of thing. If we can reach that kind of cooperation now, then there's a chance for humanity as a whole. And what we're doing here in this hemisphere, in the northern hemisphere of the Americas, what we're proposing to do with Canada, the United States, including Alaska, and Mexico, and in conjunction with Asians through what is going to be a new tunnel between Asia and Alaska, and a new development of a new rail system, a modern rail system, to unite these parts of the world, which are among the great important raw materials areas of the world, for this kind of project. That's essentially my intention. That's my mission. And with that, I leave that back to you.
Smoking time.
Oh, okay. He hop over to Sloopning.
You're filling in.
Transmit to the people.
Yeah, sure. Simply, as I said, I think what we should look at this prospect we're discussing in terms of cooperation among Canada, Alaska, and Mexico, and the implications of that for cooperation with other parts of the world, such as Siberia and so on. We have to look at that as it has its own merits, intrinsic merits. Particularly in a time of crisis now, we need a recovery program, so to speak, to compensate for the collapse of the world economy. But more important is to look at this as the reality of the advantage of the other. The reality that each of us, as in each our nations, should think about what we can do that's going to be beneficial for other nations. And saying that the benefit we do for other nations with what we're doing, it means that our children and grandchildren will benefit from the good that we're doing for the world at large. And that, I think, which is the principle of Westphalia, which is also the ancient Greek term agape, which is an essential element of Christian belief, of agape, or what's called charity, or what's called love, that this is the essential principle. If we love mankind and can love the benefit given to the other nation, what are we doing that's good for them? If we can think in those terms, then we will get away from the dog-eat-dog tendency, which we've seen again lately, and get back to the idea that we are not animals. We do not breed progeny. We develop human beings, and we hope that the next generation will have a life better than ours because we have made that improvement possible. And we see progress of this type induced by our love of mankind as being the motive for the way we do things as well as what we do. If we can get that back, that conception of agape, that principle of the Treaty of Westphalia, if we can get that back, I think we not only can recover from this crisis which is coming down on us now, but we can also assure ourselves that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren would benefit from what we're doing. And perhaps in this way we'll avoid more of the kinds of hell we've had, particularly over the past 100 years.
Thank you.
agape, men vil sige på dens næstekærlighed.
I mean, he's touched on it before, but yeah. This he comes straight up
yeah.
And says it all.
Wow. Og så opgaven er at prøve at give den her gnist af næstekærlighed som en grundlag for økonomisk politik, for strategisk politik til den næste demokratisk præsidentkandidat.
Yeah.
Og det er opgaven af den her skrift. Hvordan skaber vi en kompetent præsidentkandidat? Vi har 2 måneder
yeah.
mellem nu og midt i februar måned, når de første primærvalg begynder i først Iowa caucuses og så primærvalgene i New Hampshire. Og lige nu har vi en gruppe præsidentkandidater, som kunne være kompetente, men lige nu misgår rundt og siger, hvad der skulle siges for at blive valgt, i stedet for at virkelig fungere som en leder, som kan inspirere andre i sådan en vigtig tidspunkt.
Bliver den her sendt til kandidaterne?
Det går jeg ud fra.
Det går jeg også meget ud. Så det kan være det. Så de kan forstå den, for den er ikke let at forstå.
Var der noget jeg siger om den her, eller skal vi bare komme i gang?
Det er den, ikke den. Den her.
Ja. Right, ja. Ja, okay. Det er bare en ny udgave. Okay.
Jeg skal bare finde min. Den her er svær, at least.
Ja, det kan jeg bare forstå. Feedstock.
Jeg læste den i går, men jeg har også spurgt, du vil sige, hvor den var svær. Meget nettet spørg.
Ja. Ja, det er sådan, nogle gange skriver han på den måde. Så.
For ikke at sige altid.
Ja, og ja, man kan sige det.
Men det er en værre, eller bedre, end det plejer.
Okay, ja.
Okay. I can start. Our USA needs a real candidate. Let there be a time of thanksgiving. Det er fordi det man skriver på den 22. november. Vi in Thanksgiving. With no less than the humility with which the author presents this report to the deserving, intended next president of our United States, I present him or her the following, November 22nd, 2007. Since approximately July 25th of this year, the world as a whole has been gripped by what survivors of this present calamity would probably remember as what was in the process of becoming the greatest global financial chain reaction collapse in modern history. We could escape the worst of those effects even now if we were prepared to end the babel of the presently bankrupt globalized monetary financial system and to adopt immediately an appropriate form of a new world system composed of, respectively, perfectly sovereign nation states. The measures needed to rescue society from the presently ongoing general collapse are knowable. The question is, will society have both the knowledge and the will needed to make the change? A change from the policies of what has become, up to this point, more than 3 disastrous recent decades of terribly wrong decisions, contrary to the original intention of the New Bretton Woods system. Hans Henrik, you want to read the next?
Yes, well, I would like to have something to read from. I don't have anything.
Oh.
So where do I start?
Next paragraph. So yes. Far.
So far, none. I repeat, none. Among the visible pre-candidacies for the U.S. presidency has shown even a meager sign of commitment to competent policies for leading this republic out of and away from the continuing causes of the presently onrushing breakdown crisis of the planet. That lack of the competent policies which should have been adopted by those candidates is a key contributing element in the planet's presently accelerating plunge toward a new dark age. To restate that crucial fact, our proper task now is to prevent a dark age, which would be of several future generations' duration in its immediate effects, were it permitted to continue its present course. To begin to understand our Republic's present predicament, we should recognize that we are thus now gripped globally by a crisis which has no comparable precedent in modern European history, not since the infamous medieval 14th century New Dark Age. We in the USA could still, and must now, act immediately to arrest the present midstream onrush of that oncoming catastrophe. Admittedly, for this purpose, we do have one or two capable personalities from among the current roster of candidates, but alas, none of them have presently qualified themselves for this extraordinary mission, unless he or she were to change his or her present candidacy in ways which could be supplied only as beneficial guidance from some relevant intervention, as it were delivered from above. We must not blame all of those candidates too much for their shortcoming on this account, but we must nonetheless blame them vigorously. The relevant fact is that they represent largely a generation born usually between 1945 and 1958 to become part of a specifically white-collar tradition, the 68er, tradition of the children of the 1950s white-collar and organization man generation, in most of Europe as in the USA. It is a generation of 68ers which has been educated in hostility to any competent view of the social elements of economic processes. Worse, if they have any comprehension of economics at all, it has been indoctrination from a press and academia as ignorant or even more ignorant than they are. All candidates, academia and press alike are currently expressing the kinds of absurd but widespread beliefs which are largely responsible for the mess in which the virtually doomed present civilization finds itself today.
Just 1 minute. Den her, hvor han siger, at hostility to any competent view of the social elements of economic processes. Det er interessant, at han siger, at det er deres manglende forståelse for, hvordan en samfund kan være i stand til at skabe real økonomisk vækst med hensyn til alt det sociale.
Ja. Per Forsen.
Tell you my mission here.
Yeah.
My mission here is hopefully to enable at least one such prospective presidential candidate, but hopefully more, become capable not only of understanding this challenge, but capable of taking up the unprecedented specific kind of job of leadership which needs to be provided immediately now. Consider all of the candidates who are either in the race now or the third man independent candidacy of New York Mayor Bloomberg, who is apparently waiting for a timely moment to launch an intended threat to Senator Hillary Clinton's presently probable candidacy, as Ross Perot did against George H.W. Bush in 1994. The job to be done must be by a candidate who would be electable and would consent to be guided into becoming a competent and decent choice for the future of our nation and the world. Je tänker bara väl, vad tänker kandidaten när de läser den sättning? Verifier. Both our republic and the world as a whole are in the present grip of a classically, globally tragic situation. But for my age, I would be the only possible candidate who could actually be presently considered intellectually competent for the role which the next U.S. president must perform under these present historically extraordinary conditions. So far, none of the present candidates has shown any grasp of the crucial specific strategic quality of tasks of leadership, and which not only our republic, but on which civilization as a whole would depend if the world as a whole were not already fated to be plunged very, very soon into a deep and prolonged new dark age. Therefore, apart from the fact that the mass media orchestrated campaign debates have been given more of the character of childish spats than serious attention to the actual business at hand, the choice of potentially credible prospective candidates is limited to less than a handful who are intellectually and emotionally capable of changing their present habits by absorbing the guidance in economic expertise and related matters which they presently lack, but which I would give freely to each or all of them as I do here. Specifically, most of the campaigning by the candidates so far has either expressed simple ignorance of the actual policies on which our republic's survival urgently depends, or is a victim of his or her disqualifying habit of avoiding those issues which the big campaign financiers, who seem to own most of the candidates, might consider unpleasant. Oh, there are motives. A candidate who fails to change what has been heretofore, that prevalent failure shared among all visible leading candidates, would be remembered chiefly for his or her part in bringing that both monstrous national and global tragedy for which our people would suffer for generations to come. So the time has passed for societies continuing to tolerate recent decades' customary games of populists and sophistry. The world can no longer tolerate those petty schoolyard-like games of childishly competitive political sports into which our republic's principal pre-candidates have been lured in this campaign thus far. Hence, we were not God.
Yeah. Okay, I go on. What we must demand. For scientifically grounded reasons, which will be provided within this report, we must reject any candidate who fails to rely upon reawakening the seemingly already lost but unique historical advantage which we still have as a nation. We must reject summarily any candidate who does not rely, without swerving into other ways, on that specific intention of our federal constitution, which provides the uniquely appropriate premise for crafting a remedy for the present terrible economic threat to our world as a whole. The essence of that needed option, for which the original founding of our republic's history provides us guidance, lies principally in a recognition of three historically defined crucial points of principle as follows. 1. That in all truly successful forms of nation-state government since the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, the morally acceptable design for the modern sovereign form of nation-republic has been defined by the principle of agape. As I said, in Danish we would say næstekærlighed. As that named principle is traced to such ancient precedents as Plato and the Christian apostles John and Paul. This is the same notion as expressed by Gottfried Leibniz's denunciation of John Locke, as Leibniz affirmed the notion of the principal right of people to the pursuit of happiness. This was as opposed to John Locke's clause, which then got into the Southern Confederacy Constitution, of the right of property.
Ah.
What are the two that come before that? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, said John Locke.
Okay.
And Leibniz said, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And he said this before the revolution in the
U.S.? Leibniz, yes.
Before that.
Right, yeah.
So they just copied it from.
Yeah. This was the also the intervention of, actually I think that Thomas Jefferson had originally written Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Property.
Oh.
And Benjamin Franklin, there was a three-man committee to write the Declaration of Independence, with Benjamin Franklin being the elder statesman and the brains behind it. And then he said, no, we have to change this to Pursuit of Happiness. That treatment of the concept of agape by Leibniz was not only central to our 1776 Declaration of Independence, it was elaborated as the functional ruling principle of our constitutional law, as the preamble of our federal constitution. Det den var man har den her de her korte sætninger som understreger at det er det almene vel som er grundlaget for det er den overordnede princip. This already abused indispensable principle of U.S. constitutional law adopted from Leibniz has been virtually obliterated from national practice under the horribly tragic administration of President George W. Bush Jr. and his accomplices. It has also been the trend of tragic behavior by the complicit majority on each side of the aisle, det vil sige på begge sider i kongressen, in much of the attempted lawmaking during the terms of the 2001 to 2007 Bush administration, and also, usually, the Congress itself, especially so since February 2006. As for the effect of the incumbency of the current president and his vice president, that can be fairly described as comparable to a situation in which science fiction's pod people had taken power. De nogle sci-fi, de nogle fra ude fra andre planeter, som kom ind og kapper folk.
Det var faktisk de fjernsynet, de havde fjernsynet, ja. Og vi kaldte det agurke for folkene. Ja. Vi elskede det. Ja.
Okay, vil du læse videre?
Ja. To. That in all successful forms of nation state during the interval since the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, agape has been expressed in international affairs as the obligation of each society to be governed by the principle of each being bound by the obligation of affording the advantage of the other. By that standard, much of our so-called political classes' putative leadership is presently behaving as a pack of self-doomed barbarians. 3. That the mode of government must now become, again, our electorate's adherence to the fact that the superiority of the design of the U.S. Republic as an economy is lodged in the constitutional preference for a credit system in opposition to that implicitly imperialist character which is intrinsic in the practice of usury under an Anglo-Dutch liberal monetary system. We must rid ourselves of the most reckless, the most evil, the most destructive, most usurious present form of a monetarist system, a so-called free trade system.
Let's stop here. Hvad vi ser er forskel mellem, hvad jeres opfattelse af forskel, når Lynn snakker om en kreditsystem på den ene side og et monetært system på den anden side?
At bankerne giver kredit til folk, der vil lave fabrikker, og til staten, der vil for eksempel grave telefonlinjer ned, sådan noget. Det er kreditsystemet.
Ja.
Det andet, det er spekulation.
Ja.
Men hvad har han imod free trade? Det vil jeg gerne vide.
Hvad vil du sige til det?
Jamen, der sker jo det, at man flytter al produktion hen, hvor den er billigst. Og så bliver man ved med at flytte den hele tiden. Hver gang.
Det er global system.
Ja, men er det ikke også free trade? Altså, og det er jo det er ikke konstruktivt, altså det er bare at udnytte ressourcerne, og så når de så er udnyttet, så gå hen til en anden befolkningsressourcer. Og så helt så det fører ikke til noget konstruktivt.
Det er i hvert fald ikke agape. Det er langt fra.
Ja.
Det er udnyttelse.
Det er den her købe billig, sælge dyre, merchant ikke princip. men det er den modsætning til at opbygge nationale økonomier, hvor man forsøger at producere så meget som muligt selv og få gang i alle hjulene.
Yeah.
Og ikke være baseret på en empirisk type system, hvor, som den britiske empire, hvor vi kom, om lidt kommer vi til det her 1763
Treaty of Paris.
Treaty of Paris, hvor man etablerer, hvor den britiske imperium system bliver etableret for alvor, baseret på East India Company, hvor det var at gå ud og som Hans Hendrik siger, at misbruge en alt for billig arbejdskraft, eller i den værste tilfælde en slave system, hvor det er mennesket selv, som bliver til noget, man kan købe og sælge. Ja. Jeg tænker det på, at en kreditsystem, det er, at penge er noget, som er en middel til at sætte gang i noget, som kan faktisk forbedre livsstandarden for alle mennesker.
Yeah.
Det er bare et middel til at sætte noget arbejde i gang. Mens en monetær system er baseret på, at formålet med penge, det er at yngle flere penge, og gennem, som du sagde, og dermed, at uanset hvordan og det bliver til, vi har set i det sidste periode, det er, at jo mere man kan yngle penge gennem forskellige fiksfakserier, der har med bare penge at gøre, i stedet for at producere noget, så jo bedre.
Jeg vil bare sige, at hele mit liv har folk synes, det var fint, at man nedlægger tariffer. Og når man nedlægger tariffer, det kalder jeg free trade.
Ja.
At det er meget naiv i politik. Jeg kender intet til det.
Ja. Men hvad var formålet med de her tariffer?
Protections.
Ja. Men hvad var formålet med dem?
At staten får nogle indtægter.
Det vil jeg sige var en biprodukt.
Beskytte sin egen produktion.
Ja, yeah. Ja. Det var formålet, og en biprodukt var, wow, at staten tjente nogle penge. Det er rigtigt. Men det vil sige, at for eksempel i Amerikas begyndelse, så var de op imod, at Storbritannien, som havde en stor grund til, at det var en revolution, det var, at Storbritannien behandlede de amerikanske kolonier som kolonier. Ja. Det vil sige, at de skulle ikke fremstille noget som helst. De skulle bare aflevere råstoffer, og så købe de engelske produkter. Og så efter krigen, så, hvor de var blevet uafhængige, så var spørgsmålet, okay, hvordan kunne de begynde at oprette designfabrikker.
Ja. Så Eli Whitney and the carpenter.
Så skulle det være en vis tolvmure beskyttelse,
ja,
af de her spædbarnsindustrier. Ja.
Ja. De har sikkert gjort det, ligesom englænderne gjorde det, før de begyndte at lave fabrikker. Folk har siddet hjemme og spundet ud og strikket det.
Ja. Og det var faktisk en middel til, i den politiske kamp i Amerika under revolutionen. Det var en boykot af britiske produkter, og så skulle de spin design stuff og sådan noget. Okay.
Kvinderne har haft travlt.
Ja.
Skal jeg læse videre?
Så? Skal vi videre?
Ja. There are in turn three leading moral and other crucial historical advantages subsumed by the foregoing threefold constitutional characteristic of the US system, moral and intellectual advantages over, for example, the current morally wretched Fabian system of government of Great Britain. These advantages include A. That protectionist feature of the settlement of what became the U.S. Federal Constitution, the feature which chiefly has made our republic so vastly, morally and otherwise superior to the sophist system of the United Kingdom. This advantage was then and remains the influence of those settlers who shaped our immigrant patriot's character. Those settlers who emigrated from Europe with the intention to bring the best of the classical culture of Europe to a North America which had been located then at a relatively advantageous distance from the reach of the European legacy of usury and aristocracy. B.
We have a footnote.
Okay.
But I have to get my better glasses for the footnote.
Okay. This was the explicit motive which Christopher Columbus adopted from his study of certain writings of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, and which prompted the moral, as distinct from the depraved settlers from Spain, into Central and South America. It was the takeover of England under James I, at James I, whose circles of depraved creatures such as Sir Francis Bacon were under the influence of the New Venice Liberalism of Paolo Sarpi, and under the legacy which Sarpi's personal lackey Galileo induced in Thomas Hobbes, Locke, Bernard Mandeville, et al. This disgusting situation in Europe prompted the role of those American circles whose intellectual and moral superiority, as expressed by the Winthrops, Mathers, and Benjamin Franklin, did the most to make the USA a republic with a kind of federal constitution which our own contemporary liberals in the Anglo-Dutch liberal tradition have hated and worked to subvert and destroy from that time up to the present day.
Kenny, to New Venice and Paolo Sarpi and Hobbes, Locke, Mandeville.
Hvad siger du med dem?
Kenny, to dem her, eller skal vi snakke lidt om det?
Ja, det har vi hørt lidt om.
Ja, til Mandeville har jeg ikke hørt om det.
Nej.
Mandeville, det var ham, han skrev en bog, som hedder The Fable of the Bees, og princippet var, at alle sammen laster vices, hvis vi opfordrer alle til at bare
gøre som
de har lyst og alle deres laster, så er det ligesom en lokomotiv for samfundets udvikling.
No.
Private vices, public good.
Uh-huh.
Det var hans udgangspunkt.
Nå.
Jamen det er ligesom dem, som siger, jamen vi kan lige så godt legalisere marijuana og alle de her ting, fordi så er det godt for statskassen og cigaretter og and the other thing.
Well.
Men det her Paul Sarpi, The New Venice, det var den her overgang. Paul Sarpi var nøglen til overgang fra den gamle venetianske spekulations monetarist baseret system og Storbritannien,
ja.
Som den efterfølge.
En bankier, der flyttede til London eller sådan noget.
Han var en præst, faktisk.
Nå, okay.
Han var en præst, som ikke troede på Gud.
Ja.
Men han var...
Den sidste.
Men han var med, og ja, Thomas Hobbes. Vi havde lidt om ham for nogle uger siden. Thomas Hobbes, det var ham, som... han mente, at menneske i bund og grund er bæster.
Yeah.
Og at den naturlige tilstand af menneske, det er at forsøge at dræbe hinanden, og alles krig mod alle. Og at samfundet er opfundet som en måde at lægge bånd på menneskets naturlige trang til at dræbe hinanden. Og det er hans menneskesyn.
Original sin.
Ja. Original og vedvarende.
Han var ikke særlig kristen, hvad? Ja, for hvis han er kristen, så tror man ikke på, at man bliver ved med at være old. Så man måske tror, at man er født old.
Ja, men det har også været fraktionskamp inden for kristendommen om sådan noget,
yeah.
hvor nogen, for eksempel kalvinisterne i Schweiz, som med udgangspunkt i Schweiz, de mente, at man kunne vide, om en person var god eller dårlig, baseret på, om de var rig eller fattig, fordi...
Er det ikke så? Er det ikke grinagtigt?
Fordi de rige var udvalgt. De udvalgte. Fordi de var gode. Og hvis folk var fattige, så var det ikke, fordi det var designs skyld, og det var, fordi det var noget i vejen med dem. Okay. Videre.
Yeah, fortsat, B. The significance of the establishment of the United Kingdom under King George I as successor to England's Queen Anne was that his accession embodied the defeat of the cause of the Patriotic Party in England, a party which had leaned toward the option of choosing Leibniz's assistance, a party whose defeat had worked in favor of that pro-imperialist Anglo-Dutch liberalism whose power was consolidated under William of Orange's Hanoverian protege, King George I. Footnote 2. Graham Lowry, How the Nation Was Won. When Britain reached out with the 1763 Peace of Paris to take away our liberties, our patriots revolted in defense of a civilized form of life.
For en ting her med det her med King George og Queen Anne, vi har den her bog, Graham Lowry, How the Nation Was Won. Det er en af vores bøger,
ja.
Og det er faktisk det, som fungerer som den første bind til en historieprojekt, som vi nu er i gang med at udgive som bind 2. For den her America's Untold Story, Volume 1, 1630 to 1754. Det er den fraktionskamp, det var i Europa, som resulterede i, at som vi lige har læst, at det var nogle kreds, som tog til Amerika for at etablere en republik langt fra oligarkiet i Europa. Men det her med King George og Queen Anne, fordi Queen Anne var dronning i Storbritannien, men hun havde ikke nogen aftager. Siger man aftager?
Arving.
Arving. Og man besluttede, at grevinde Sophia af Hanover skulle være den næste dronning. Den eneste problem med Sophia var, at Leibniz var hans hovedrådgiver. Problem, mener jeg i gårsøjen, i følge den oligarkiske fraktion. Yeah. Og, men problem for vores fraktion var, at Sophia var en ældre dame på daværende tidspunkt. Og så var det et spørgsmål om, hun ville nogensinde komme til magten. Og desværre døde hun, og hendes søn, George, som blev George the First, var sådan set kapret af den oligarkiske fraktion. Så han blev
ikke så god.
Nej. Men man kan læse meget mere i den her udmærkede bog. Og så har vi også igen her den her 1763 Peace of Paris, som afsluttede krigen mellem Frankrig og Storbritannien og fik etableret den britiske imperium. Det er faktisk en hvad er det, footnote? Vi har et footnote.
Jeg kan ikke vide, hvornår George the First, hvornår han blev konge. Om det har noget at gøre med The Peace of Paris. Om han allerede var konge.
Let's see. King George. Han var kong fra 1714 til 27, så det var langt inden.
Okay.
Ikke langt, men
så det må være en anden George, da revolutionen kom.
Det var George den 3.
Ja.
The famous George den
3. Ja, den jeg kunne huske, hvad for en George det var.
Ja.
Kun navnet.
Okay, vil du gerne læse?
Ja. Yeah. Under the leadership of President Franklin Roosevelt, our republic has returned one more time to the impulse of our dedication to those principles. The work done then in that direction was not completed, but it was underway. With President Franklin Roosevelt's untimely death, the process of progress was aborted under his immediate successor. The same betrayal of principle was carried out to a worse degree with the sophistry of the 1968ers in both Europe and the Americas. So, with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, what had been the partly shackled devils of our destruction were abruptly unleashed. We were stricken by the prolonged virtual imitation of each of a long series of wars, like the Peloponnesian War of a self-doomed ancient Greece. These have been wars launched during the interval of 1964-2007 to date, by repeated consent of the majorities of the U.S. Congress, and most emphatically by outright, implicitly treasonous fraud of forces controlling the administration of the presently incumbent president. Those foolish wars have been an emblematic feature of a series of global developments which have brought both our own ruined republic and the world at large into the onset of what will soon become, unless stopped, a global new dark age, roughly comparable to that of Europe's 14th century. The worst of these wars have been those promoted under what President Dwight Eisenhower denounced as a military-industrial complex. Now, I'm old enough to remember when Eisenhower said that on television, and I saw it and was very impressed. My parents, too, they were Democrats, but they said, wow, there's an honest man and a courageous man.
Yeah, og han var soldat selv.
Yeah. Or the same complex named by others a revolution in military affairs. And this was associated with Samuel P. Huntington, the soldier and state. For, under London's Fabian-sponsored brutish U.S. Vice President Cheney, and Cheney's London-linked U.S. protectors George Shultz and Middlebury, Vermont's Gretchen Felix Rohatyn, or however you say it.
Rohatyn,
okay. C. The original economic policy, which had made the U.S.'s constitutionally defined economic policy morally or otherwise superior to that of the United Kingdom, is expressed as our patriots' constitutional abhorrence of a free trade system. The Anglo-Dutch liberal model, called monetarism today, is axiomatically a financial oligarchical and inherently imperialist system of government. Three.
Oh, we have it on the bottom here.
Three. The 1971-72 breakup by the Richard Nixon administration of what President Franklin Roosevelt had launched as the Bretton Woods system of fixed exchange rates had the effect of returning the USA to a more and more subordinate role as a mere subject of the British imperial free trade system. In addition to the fact that this was a clearly